Now, when he saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. The disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, saying,
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn.
I love the story of the man who went to see his doctor. And the doctor told him, I'm sure I have the answer to your problem. And the man answered, I certainly hope so, doctor. I should have come to you a long time ago. And the doctor asked, well, where did you go before? The man said, I went to the pharmacist. And the doctor kind of snidely asked, well, what kind of foolish advice did he give you? And the man said, well, he told me to come see you. You know, sometimes it seems that we always go first to the wrong places to get the real solution to our problems. I don't know, maybe it's just a part of being human. I don't know. But it seems as we always have to go finally to the place where we have no other place to go, then we finally turn to the Lord. And I suppose it's at that time that we come closest to being what this beatitude really addresses. And that is contrition of heart and humility of spirit. Blessed, what does that mean? Well, if you remember from last week, we quoted from the biblical scholar Rabbi Stephen Schwarzschild, who said that it's something like being on the right path, on the way the Creator wants us to go. I hope that you'll see that, because it never talks about arriving, does it? It never says that it's a destination. It says that you're on the right path. You're heading in the right direction. I think in the Beatitudes, and I hated to cut Jesus off that way this morning in our video, but you'll be seeing this again and again as we complete the series of sermons on the Beatitudes. But overall, Jesus gives us a key here that can unlock the door to what we're really all seeking. We call it different things perhaps, but what we're really after is a life of joy and a life of contentment. And I think as we give thought to these eight statements, perhaps we can discover a whole new set of priorities, because these Beatitudes are not just individually contained as we preach them to you. They're all intricately interwoven and as a whole present a life of blessedness and happiness. Jesus is touching on one of the tenets of the gospel here in his Sermon on the Mount. In fact, this is the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And that is the concept that God can really reach us when, and usually only when, we're in a contrite position or a seemingly sad situation. For me, I think, I don't know, I like to blame it on my nature. But I have to be backed into a corner. I mean, you know, I have to be just beaten down and exhausted after trying everything I can do. Then I'm at this point. And that's sad, isn't it? Sad that anybody would be that way. But this is what he's talking about. And I hopefully, you're not like that. But there's another little slant that I ran across in Matthew's gospel in a commentary that helped me understand even the Beatitudes in a little bit different way. And that is that the word blessed also has the connotation of the word congratulations. Congratulations in the way in which someone would congratulate you for achieving a certain thing or goal or whatever we congratulate one another for, you know what we're extending when we say congratulations, don't you? Well, this is another way of looking at what God, through Christ, is saying to us, is that congratulations, man. Congratulations for reaching this point where you're really ready and open and can really receive what I want to provide for you. Jesus, as a way, as He always did, used words that His audience understood. And I think Jesus used the term poor in the Greek, that means someone that's desperately ashamed even to allow their identity to be known. Now, I don't know how many of you have had occasion to go to some of our larger cities and walk them. And I'm sure you have, but we have in most of our major cities a large portion of homeless people who literally live on the street, and they literally are begging. If you've ever been to San Francisco, was one of the places where I saw it most prominently. But these people, many of them, aren't proud to be there. They won't look you in the eye, primarily because we don't look them in the eye. We pretend that they're not there. We just pretend they don't exist. That's the only way, you see, our conscience will allow us to walk by them. It really is just pretend they're not there. But being poor and to beg, to literally have to stoop to begging, if you've never been there, you don't know what it's like. So I can't tell you. And neither can most of us here. Some of us have been in a poor financial shape, but we've never been on the street to literally have to beg for the next meal. So it's in that same way that Jesus is referring to our spirits. William Barclay says that for a Hebrew, being poor meant having no influence, power, or prestige. In other words, they were considered a nobody. And when you combine the word poor and the words in spirit, Jesus is indicating something that is far different and much deeper than our economic condition. Instead, Jesus is really congratulating those who possess a spirit that knows that if one is to make it through life, one needs help. One cannot do it on their own. That's what this beatitude is talking about. Blessed are those who are so desperately poor in their spiritual resources that they realize they must have outside help. John Wesley described it like this: he or she who has a deep sense of loathsome leprosy of sin. So that's what Jesus is in a roundabout way saying. Blessed are those who recognize that they do not possess adequate spiritual resources, for theirs is the kingdom of God. There's a poignant incident related in Elizabeth Yates' book, Howard Thurman, Portrait of a Practical Dreamer. When Howard Thurman was in India in 1935, he spoke in many of the villages. And late one night, there was a knock on his door. And he went to the door and he saw a young lad there. And he was dressed in a way that revealed that he was one of the unfortunate ones in Indian society. He was one of the untouchables. If you know anything about the caste system in India, you know that being an untouchable was literally that. You weren't even worthy of a touch. You are just Nobody. And this little lad asked Mr. Thurman, he said, "Sahib Doctor, I listened to your lectures outside the building, and I just want to know, can you give me some hope as a nobody?" I know many of our youth maybe can relate to that, relate to this better than some of us adults. But we all know what it's like somehow to be in the midst of other people and be overlooked or counted as insignificant. But to be a nobody. And that little boy fell to his knees, and Thurman himself, who so happened to have lived in poverty himself and in the slums of one of our larger cities, fell down upon his knees and hugged him and embraced him compassionately. He knew what it was like to be a nobody. And I want you to know this morning that this beatitude gives hope to those who consider themselves as a nobody. That Jesus is saying to you particularly, if you consider yourself as a nobody, then I can really reach you. Through this first beatitude, we can learn several things, but one is that true greatness springs from humble beginnings. The late Lloyd Conan once told Dennis Whately, he said, "The very best people in the world will never be known by many. They do not seek publicity nor waste their time with vanity. Since they lead exemplary, healthy lives, they are rarely covered by the media, who tend to focus mostly on the sensational, the controversial, and the bizarre. But once in a while," he said, "once in a while they do make history, and usually they're in world leadership positions." One such person of humble beginnings was Mahatma Gandhi. Even after becoming an internationally recognized political leader, Gandhi persisted in following an extremely Spartan lifestyle. He wore the simple clothes of the poor. He traveled on foot whenever possible, preferred staying in the slum areas of the cities that he visited, and he always used the cheapest class of travel. And in that day and time, of course, the travel was by train. And as you know, Gandhi was a controversial leader as he opposed the British government and their authority and their governing over the Indian citizens. So the British government had to provide him some sort of secret service, I guess is the best way to put it. And Lord Lewis Mountbatten, the British viceroy, was in charge of Gandhi's secret service. They had to accompany him wherever he went. And someone remembered how Gandhi would always choose to travel with the untouchables in the untouchable train car, because no one else, of course, would travel there. He would travel with them. And the Lord Viceroy Mountbatten said to one of his security men, "You have no idea what it costs to keep this old man in poverty." But that was the rub between society as we know it and the spirit in which we live life. Gandhi was familiar with the caste system. He knew what it was like to be a nobody. And you look at this man and you marvel at how he could bring this mighty British empire to its knees. It's incredible. Albert Einstein was right when he said that generations to come will scarce believe that such a one as this ever in flesh and blood walked upon this earth. His only weapon of opposition was an indomitable spirit and a resolve for equality and freedom. And he once said that nonviolence is the greatest force at the disposal of mankind. Nonviolence. It is mightier than the mightiest weapon of destruction devised by the ingenuity, I didn't pronounce that right, by the genius of man. While Gandhi never raised his walking cane to strike those who opposed him, it didn't mean that he wasn't a fighter. He was. But he was a humble man. And we see how humility and leadership can indeed bring with it great force. There was a line in an award-winning movie that reminded me of Gandhi. It starred Clint Eastwood in the role of Frankie Dunn, a down-on-his-luck former boxing manager who spends the twilight years of his life running a small, dilapidated gym in downtown Los Angeles. And Frankie's previous career was blighted by an injury to one of his prize fighters, a man they called Scrap. It was played by Morgan Freeman. He lost his sight in his right eye during a particularly brutal bout. And Scrap now whiles away the hours working as a cleaner in Frankie's gym. Wary of similar occurrences being inflicted on the prestigious young talent that passed before him, Frankie really was reluctant ever to let someone again lose their eyesight, and as a result, lost many of his fighters to other trainers. But there was this one fighter, this young boxer, brash and confident, by the name of Maggie Fitzgerald, played by Hilary Swank. And Frankie's life is what you'd call irretrievably altered by her past. And initially, Frankie refuses to train Maggie due to her gender and her age. But Frankie finally relents when he is faced with her tenacity and her spirit and her burning ambition. So I would like for you to just view one of the little parts of this movie. There's several, really, but this was one that was particularly memorable to me.
Frankie likes to say that boxing is an unnatural act, that everything in boxing is backwards. Sometimes the best way to deliver a punch is step back.
Well, do your best, Lord, to protect Katie. Henny, too. Other than that, you know what I want. There's no use me repeating myself.
But step back too far. You ain't fighting at all.
Sometimes the best prayers are the shortest ones. Sometimes it's a recognition of God knows what's on our heart. But Frankie, here, played by Clint Eastwood, is one of those men who seeks for some kind of peace in his life. And throughout that movie, he even hassles this priest constantly. But it's a very poignant movie in regard that even Maggie herself has a spirit of humility about her as she seeks to overcome everything that life has heaped upon her. Excuse me, she came from humble beginnings, but that doesn't stop her. And I guess my point in this all of this is that just simply because you have a humble spirit about you doesn't mean that you're a quitter, that you're a doormat, and that you're not a fighter. But there is a fight within people of humility, even like Gandhi and like Martin Luther King Jr. and many others that we see cross our path. There is a poverty that that is equally dehumanizing, that has nothing to do even with our economic status. Dennis Whately, in his book, Being the Best, quotes the following. He says that poverty is untested potential resulting from self-imposed limitations. Poverty is working a lifetime doing something you don't like so you can retire and do something you like at age 65. Poverty is having many acquaintances and not knowing any of them well. Poverty is having so many clothes you haven't a thing to wear. Poverty is having every pill imaginable to cure your body's ills because you can't afford to be sick. Poverty is being loaded down with toys at birthdays and Christmas and then being bored silly because there's nothing to do. Poverty is having 3 degrees and feeling unfulfilled in your job. Poverty is having 2 cars, 3 TVs and a dishwasher, and then roughing it by going camping to get away from it all. Poverty is going day to day from one building to the next and never stopping to see the beauty of the world outside. Poverty is spending money on makeup, deodorant, cologne, and designer clothes and still being worried about the image you're projecting. Poverty is being white, healthy, middle class, and unhappy. Poverty is never being curious about the world around you and never wanting to explore it or the people in it. Poverty is as much of the soul as it is the body. The nobodies in this world can perhaps take comfort in knowing that the spotlight sometimes shines on those out of the limelight. Mother Teresa's of this world do win Nobel Prizes. They're few and far between, but they do win them. A truly humble person is hard to find, yet God delights to honor such selfless people. I remember a story about Booker T. Washington, the renowned black educator. I think he's an outstanding example of this truth. Shortly after he took over the presidency of Tuskegee Institute, he was walking out in one of the exclusive sections of town when he was stopped by a wealthy white woman. And she asked him if he would like to earn a few dollars by chopping wood for her. He didn't recognize her. I mean, she didn't recognize him. I mean, because he had no pressing business at the moment, Professor Washington smiled and he rolled up his sleeves and he proceeded to do this humble chore as she had requested. And when he was finished, he carried the logs into the house and he stacked them by the fireplace. And the little girl who was in the house at the time happened to recognize him and later revealed his identity to this lady. But the next morning, the embarrassed woman went to see Mr. Washington in his office at the Institute and she apologized profusely. And Mr. Washington said to her, "Oh, it's perfectly all right, madam." He said, "I didn't mind. Occasionally I need a little manual labor. Besides, it's always a delight to do something for a friend." She shook his hand warmly and assured him that his meek and gracious attitude had endeared him and his work to her heart. And not long afterward, she showed her admiration by persuading some of her wealthy acquaintances to join her in donating thousands of dollars to the Tuskegee Institute. Now, Booker T. Washington didn't set out to do that for reward. But I'm just telling you, God has a way of honoring those of us who honor Him with a humble heart and a service. It was John Ruskin who once said, "I believe the first test of a truly great person is in his or her humility." And he said, "I do not mean by humility doubt of one's own power or hesitation in speaking one's opinion. But really great people," he said, "have a feeling that the greatness is not in them, but through them, and that they could not do or be anything else than God made them to be." The low road of humility sometimes does indeed lead to the high land of happiness. Many, however, find this road rather steep because humility is a key ingredient to happiness. It's not easy to achieve at all, if it's achievement at all. Because sometimes life has a way of bringing us to our knees, doesn't it? And I've discovered along the way that it's much rather to humble yourself than to be humbled. I don't like that at all. I mean, some of the professors that I encountered in my educational pursuits took delight in humbling me. And God knew that I needed it, but I didn't like it. And I don't suppose anybody does. Sort of reminds me of something that Winston Churchill said. He said, "I'm always ready to learn, but I do not always like being taught." And that's kind of true for all of us. But someone else said, "Be humble or you'll stumble." And how true that is. It reminds me of one story about a young American student who visited the Beethoven Museum in Bonn. And she became fascinated by the piano which Beethoven had used in composing some of his greatest work. And she asked the museum guard if she could play a few bars on it. And, of course, accompanying the request was a little bit of this, you know what I mean? She greased his palm a little bit. So the guard let her. And she went to the piano and she tinkled out the opening of the Moonlight Sonata. And as she was leaving, she said to the guard, "Well, I suppose all the great pianists who come here want to play on that piano." And the guard shook his head. And he said, "Well, no. As a matter of fact, the great Polish pianist Paderewski was here a while back, and he told me he wasn't worthy to even touch it." A sign of greatness. Winston Churchill was once asked, "You know, doesn't it thrill you to know that every time you make a speech, the hall is packed overflowing?" Well, he said, "It is quite flattering to have a good crowd." But he said, "You know, whenever I begin to feel that way, I always remember that if instead of making a political speech, I was being hanged, there would be twice as big a crowd." And that's so true. But lessons in humility are costly. But if you possess a humble spirit, the lessons of life are limitless, not the least of which is to find happiness of heart and soul. Last of all, poverty of spirit opens the door to positive possibilities. You know, happiness comes when we admit what we're lacking and where we have a need. Many years ago, Christian professor Stuart Blackie at the University of Edinburgh was listening to his students as they presented oral readings. And when one young man rose to begin his recitation, he held his book in the wrong hand, his left hand. And the professor stood up and he thundered out, "Take your book in your right hand and be seated," he said. Well, at the harsh rebuke, the student held up his right arm. And he didn't have a right hand. And you know, at that moment, it was as if the air had been sucked out of the room. As everyone gasped at this faux pas of the professor. The silence hung heavenly as time seemed to be suspended. You ever been in one of those occasions of real awkwardness? The students shifted uneasily in their chairs. For a moment, the professor hesitated. And then he rose from his chair. He made his way to the student. And he put his arm around him. And with tears streaming from his eyes, he said, "I never knew about this. I'm so sorry. Will you please forgive me?" His humble apology made a lasting impression on that young man. And this story was told sometime later in a large gathering of Christians. And at the close of that meeting, a man came forward. And he turned to the crowd that was there, and he raised his right arm. It ended at the wrist. And he said to that crowd, "I was that student. Professor Blackie led me to Christ that day. But he never could have done it if he had not made the wrong right." You hear what I'm saying? Humility, my friends, humility is what makes the wrong right. And you'll never do it. You'll never make wrong right if you don't possess a humble heart. You know, the problem many, many of us have is pride. And it may surprise you that even some preachers have it. In fact, most preachers have it. No, second thought, all preachers have it. I hate being in a crowd of preachers. It's kind of like somebody said, you know, it's kind of like manure. You know, boy, when it's all together, it's terrible. But if you spread it out, it's not so bad. That's free. I didn't intend to say that. So that's free. But did you hear about the minister who said he had a wonderful sermon on humility, but he was waiting for a larger crowd before he preached it? Someone once wrote, "Most of us camouflage our stumbling block with a hat." You ever heard the word big-headed? That's what it means. Pride prevents many of us from living in the realm of true happiness. Scripture says, "Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall." There's some truth to that classic story, I think, of the frog that decided to seek a warmer climate. And at first he thought he could, at first he, you know, he waited too late to make the journey. He knew he'd never out-hop the cold weather. So at last he hit upon a brilliant idea. He happened to have these two geese friends of his. And he said, "Hey, would you do me a favor?" He said, "Would one of you take one end of this string, the other one take this end, and let me just grab a hold of it with my mouth in the end, in the middle?" Well, they said, "Why, sure, we'll do that." So, off they flew. Here was two geese flying with a frog right in the middle. And they flew over to this pasture where a farmer was out working, and the farmer looked up and said, "Wow, what a fantastic idea. Who ever thought of that?" Well, now the frog's pride wouldn't allow him to keep quiet. And he shouted back, "I invented it." Well, in so doing, he let go of the string. And his questioner, a moment later, was looking upon a squashed frog. As in the case of a vast multitude, his pride was indeed led to his fall. And it leads to ours as well. Pride does its deadliest work by keeping us from getting the help we really need. Humility of heart and spirit is essential, my friends, before help can be received. Could this be the reason that Jesus made this the first of His Beatitudes? I think so. My question to you this morning is, are you on the right path? Are you on the right path? I hope so.